So imagine for a second that you are sitting in a college classroom.
Okay.
It's late in the semester. Everyone is just exhausted, and the air is thick with that very specific kind of academic tension. You know the vibe where people aren't just taking notes, they're actually getting mad at the professor.
Yeah, that's not your typical lecture hall boredom. That's active rebellion.
Exactly. The students are incredibly frustrated. They're raising their hands. They're challenging the material. They're basically asking, is this actually a way a human being can live?
Right.
And the professor, Dr. Arthur Holmes, is just standing there, totally calm, defending a philosophy that, quite frankly, sounds terrifying to a lot of people.
It is a great opening scene because it really captures the stakes of what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
We aren't just talking about abstract ideas here. This is a clash between our deepest human desires, for freedom and feelings, and a philosophical system that says those things might just be complete illusions.
Which brings us to the man of the hour.
Right, Baruch Spinoza.
Spinoza, the 17th century lens grinder who basically ended up grinding down the way we see the entire universe.
We really did.
And today we are doing a deep dive into a specific lecture series by Dr. Holmes that captures this exact friction perfectly. We're going to unpack a worldview where God and nature are the exact same thing,
Literally the same thing.
where free will is a complete myth, and I think this is the part that really got those students riled up, feeling pity or regret is actually considered a weakness.
It is a radically different system than how most of us operate. And I'd say the mission for this deep dive is to see if we can actually understand Spinoza's geometric worldview.
Geometric meaning like math.
Yeah, it's a system of pure, cold logic.
Yeah.
And the big question is it, as the students in the source claim, dead? Is it just a philosophy for robots? Or is it, as Holmes argues, maybe the only way to find actual peace in a totally chaotic world?
So let's get right into the machinery of it. Spinoza starts with a concept that sounds simple at first, but it completely breaks your brain the more you think about it.
Double aspect monism.
Yes, Dr. Holmes calls it double aspect monism. Break that down for us, because, I mean, what does that actually mean for the listener?
Well, we have to start with the basic architecture of reality. Most of us walk around thinking the world is made of many different things.
Sure.
There's me, there's you, there's this table, there's God somewhere up in the
All
clouds.
right, a universe full of stuff.
Exactly. But Spinoza says, stop right there. That's wrong. There is only one substance, one single all-inclusive thing.
Just one.
Just one. You can call it God or you can call it nature. To Spinoza, it makes absolutely no difference.
Deusive natura.
Yes, God or nature, it is one and the same.
Okay, I'm going to play the skeptical student here for a second because that sounds really poetic. We are all one.
Very new age.
Right. But I am clearly sitting here. I have a physical body that takes up space, and I have thoughts which are completely invisible. How can my physical body and my invisible thoughts be the exact same substance? They feel totally different.
And that is the double aspect part of the theory. This is where people usually get stuck. Holmes explains that this single substance, God or nature, has infinite attributes. But as finite humans, we only have the capacity to know two of them.
Okay, what are they?
There is extension, which is material stuff, matter taking up space, and there is thought, which is conscious organization or logic.
So we have matter and we have thought.
Mm.
But you're saying they aren't two different worlds. Like there isn't a physical world down here and a spirit world up there.
No, absolutely not. And that's the crucial unlock to understanding Spinoza. Think of it like, well, Holmes uses the analogy of a curve on a piece of paper.
Right.
From one side of the paper, it looks convex. From the other side, it looks concave.
But it's the exact same line.
It's the same curve, just described in two different ways, depending on your vantage point. Or another way Holmes puts it, think of the Stoic idea of the logos. The material world and the logical structure of the world are just two sides of the same coin.
So my body is the matter side of the coin, and my mind is the logic side of the coin, but we are essentially the same coin.
Exactly. Your mind is simply the idea of your body. They are one distinct reality.
I gotta say, this leads to something that I found a bit existentially rattling in the source material.
Uh-oh.
Well, if there is only one substance, and that substance is God or nature, what am I? Because I feel like a me. I feel like a distinct person with a social security number and a favorite pizza topping.
Yeah.
Am I not a separate entity?
According to Spinoza, no. You are what he calls a finite mode.
A finite mode. That sounds incredibly temporary and small.
It is. Holmes explains that we are simply finite moments within the all-inclusive one. We are essentially like ripples in the ocean.
Ripples.
Yeah, the ripple exists, right? It has a shape. It moves across the water. But it isn't separate from the ocean. It actually is the ocean, just waving in a certain way for a very brief moment.
So my body is just a finite aspect of the physical cosmos.
Yes.
And my mind.
Yeah. Your current thoughts are actually God's thoughts, just less clear, because you only have a finite perspective.
Wow. That is heavy. And Holmes used a really specific example in the lecture to explain this idea of modes versus substance.
Yeah.
He talked about changes. Like, if my hair falls out, which, let's be honest, is a real concern for me these days.
Huh. Right. Or if you just move your position in a chair.
Yeah. If my hair falls out, that is a modification within the finite mode. It's a rearrangement of the stuff. But does God or nature change because I went bald?
Well, I would assume not. The universe doesn't mourn your hairline.
Exactly. The one is unchangingly all-inclusive. The change only happens at the level of the ripple, not the ocean itself.
Okay, so we are ripples, but ripples move. Things happen. And this leads us to the part of Spinoza that usually freaks people out the most, the machinery of determinism.
This is the engine of his entire universe. And you have to understand, Spinoza does not do things halfway. He is a thoroughgoing determinist. He believes everything that happens is completely determined by the essence of God or nature.
Meaning everything is strictly cause and effect.
An unbroken, eternal chain. Every physical event is caused by a previous physical event. Every thought you have is caused by a previous thought.
So there is no gap in the chain where free will can just jump in and change the direction.
Zero.
None.
So wait, if everything is just gears turning physical gears and mental gears, what actually keeps it moving? Why isn't the universe just a static, dead rock? Because Holmes mentioned a specific term for this.
Kenotis.
Yes, kenotis. And this is where Spinoza was arguably hundreds of years ahead of his time. Because in the 17th century, the prevailing science people like Descartes, they viewed matter as just dead stuff.
Like billiard balls.
Exactly. A billiard ball just sits there on the table until you hit it with a cue. It has no internal drive.
Just basic inertia.
Right. But Spinoza and later Leibniz, too, they suspected that matter wasn't dead at all. They thought it was bundles of energy.
Really?
Yeah. Kenotis is this inner drive, this assertiveness, this fundamental tendency of everything to persist in its own existence. So the universe isn't just a cold machine. It's actually a living, driving force.
It's a highly dynamic, energetic process. Your will to survive, your desire to eat, your heartbeat, that is the kenotis acting through you. You are a bundle of energy desperately trying to keep going.
Okay, I see that. But here comes the pushback. And this is where the students in the source material really start to rebel against Dr. Holmes.
It gets heated.
It does. There's a student who asks the question we're all thinking. He says, if everything is determined, if I'm just a ripple caused by other ripples, what is the point of trying?
The classic lazy argument. If it's all written down since the Big Bang, why should I bother studying for this exam? Why should I try to be a good person?
Right. Isn't reading Spinoza's book a complete waste of time if my reaction to it has already been decided?
It's the most natural objection in the world. And Holmes's rebuttal here is so fascinating because he refuses to step outside of Spinoza's system to answer it.
What does he say?
He argues that trying is actually part of the causal process itself. You can't just step out of the chain of cause and effect and say, I'm not playing anymore.
Because even saying I'm not playing is part of the chain.
Exactly. And he gave this incredibly relatable example that really hit home for me. He talked about lying in bed at 3 a.m.
Oh, we have all been there.
Right. You are lying there. You are exhausted. You desperately want to go to sleep. But your brain is vigorously debating a topic.
Like an argument you had in the shower 5 years ago?
Yes. Or countering proofs. Arguing with yourself over a math problem, Holmes asks the students, are you choosing to do that?
And the answer is clearly no. I mean, you would choose to sleep if you could.
Exactly. The thoughts are driving themselves. One thought triggers the next thought, which triggers the counterargument. The entire process is happening to you.
That is a genuinely scary feeling. It's like you're just a passenger in your own mind.
Oh.
But Spinoza would say, that is the reality of existence. Holmes also uses a really cool musical example to illustrate this. He talks about a professor sitting at a piano and playing a specific set of notes, like an unfinished musical phrase.
Da 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 da.
Right, and the audience spontaneously knows exactly how to finish it in their heads. Dumb. The mind is led relentlessly to the logical conclusion.
You feel like you're participating. Like, you actively decided to hum that last note.
But really, the pattern was set, the cause was input, and your mind just naturally followed the track to its inevitable end. So when the student asks, what's the point of trying, Spinoza would say, the fact that you are asking what's the point is just another link in the chain. Your trying is simply the mechanism God uses to get the result.
Man. So we are totally trapped in the logic. But if we are just finite modes in a determined machine, what does that mean for morality? Because this is where the classroom tension really spiked in the recording.
Oh, yeah.
Spinoza says good and evil don't actually exist, right?
Not in any objective sense, no. He argues that good and evil are not realities in God. God doesn't look down at the world and say, this event is evil. To Spinoza, they are confused ideas.
Confused ideas. I mean, that feels highly dismissive of some pretty terrible things that happen in the world.
It does feel that way, especially at first glance. But Spinoza means they are imaginative ideas rooted entirely in our finite, limited perspective. Look, if something helps your conatus, if it helps you survive or thrive, you label it good. If it hurts you, you label it evil.
But to the universe itself.
To the universe, it's just an event. It's just gears turning.
So a virus isn't evil, a thunderstorm isn't evil.
Right. And Spinoza extends that exact same logic to human actions. It's all just nature unfolding. And because of that, Spinoza launches a massive attack on our emotions.
Hmm.
Specifically, he goes hard after pity and repentance.
And this is where I think probably most listeners would pull the emergency brake, because we are fundamentally taught that pity and repentance are virtues. If I do something wrong, I should feel bad. I should repent. If I see someone suffering, I should feel pity, Spinoza says.
Right.
Nope, you're useless.
He calls them passions. And you have to look at the root of that word, passion. Passive. For Spinoza, a passion is something that overpowers you. It holds you in bondage.
Holmes used the stove analogy here, which I thought was brilliant.
It's the best way to understand it. If you put your hand on a hot stove and burn it, you are in pain. Now, what is the actual utility of standing there feeling repentance for the act?
Like, oh, I'm so sorry I touched the stove. I'm such an idiot. I regret this deeply.
Right. Spinoza asks, does that heal the burn? Does that change the past? No, it's quite literally crying over spilled milk. It's an overpowering emotion that just clouds your thinking. The goal shouldn't be to feel bad. The goal should be to understand the causal link. Heat burns flesh.
So understanding beats feeling.
Always. If you understand the cause, you won't do it again. That is what he calls right reason. But if you just wallow in the remorse, you're basically just suffering twice. Once from the physical burn and once from the emotional guilt. And Spinoza thinks suffering is a weakness. It actively diminishes your conatus.
So the goal of life isn't to be good in a traditional religious sense,
yeah,
but to be clear.
Yes. The goal is blessedness. And for Spinoza, blessedness comes from moving from confused imagination, where you're tossing and turning with guilt and pity, to clear, distinct understanding.
It's very stoic.
Very. It's all about tranquility. You understand your exact place in the great machine, you understand why things happen, and you just accept it.
But this brings us right back to the classroom rebellion. There's a student in the source who just isn't buying it. He tells Holmes that this philosophy feels like it was locked in a closet.
I love that quote.
He says it feels dead because it completely ignores the messiness of actual human experience.
It's a very gut-level reaction. The student basically wants to shake Spinoza and say, look at the world. It's messy. It's bloody. It's not a clean geometry problem.
And how does Holmes defend his guy against that? Because saying experience doesn't matter seems like a really hard sell.
Holmes admits that, yes, experience is important, but he actually quotes the Bible to make his point. He says, we see through a glass darkly, meaning raw experience is fuzzy. Our senses constantly lie to us. I mean, the sun looks like it moves around the earth, but we know it doesn't.
So we need logic to clean up the mess of our senses.
Exactly. And Holmes uses a military metaphor here that I think completely saves the argument. He says deductive reasoning, the strict geometric logic that Spinoza uses, is like a drill on a parade ground.
Left, right, marching in straight lines.
Right. It feels stiff. It feels artificial. You obviously don't walk like that in real life. If you walked like that in an actual battle, you'd die immediately. But the parade ground drill teaches you the internal precision and discipline you need for the actual tactics of life. Holmes argues that you can't just rely on raw, chaotic experience. You need a rigorous framework to organize it first.
Okay, I get the utility of discipline. But why geometry? Why was Spinoza so obsessed with turning human life into proofs and axioms? Why not use art? Why not history?
That is a big question.
And Holmes gives us some historical context that really blew my mind. I think we need to spend a minute here because it explains the real motivation behind all this supposedly cold logic.
We absolutely have to look at the timeline. Spinoza is writing in the 17th century. Holmes calls this a time of epistemological vacuum.
Whoa, hang on. Epistemological vacuum. That's a $5 phrase. Break that down for us.
Epistemology is simply the study of how we know things. And a vacuum means emptiness. Basically, the old ways of knowing were dead. For 1,000 years, people knew what was true because the church told them, or because Aristotle said so. But by the 17th century, the medieval authority of the church had completely broken down. The Reformation had happened.
And when the ultimate authority breaks down, people don't just politely agree to disagree.
No, they started killing each other. The 17th century was an absolute bloodbath in Europe. You had the 30 Years' War, which just decimated the continent. Catholics fighting Protestants, neighbor fighting neighbor. It wasn't just a polite theological debate. It was total violent chaos.
So there was no common ground left. If I quote the Pope, you shoot me. If you quote Luther, I shoot you.
Exactly. So Spinoza and other thinkers like Hobbes and Descartes and Grotius, they were desperate. They were looking for a way out of the slaughter. They realized they needed a scientific basis for a philosophy of life. Because if you base life purely on religious revelation, people just fight to the death over whose revelation is right.
But nobody fights about geometry.
Bingo. If I say the internal angles of a triangle equal 180 degrees, you don't say that's Catholic propaganda.
Right. You just check the math and you agree.
It is universal. It is mathematically necessary.
So this geometric method, writing a philosophy book like it's a math textbook, wasn't just Spinoza being a nerd in a closet. It was an attempt at a peace treaty.
It was a desperate attempt to save civilization. They wanted something universal that everyone must agree on, regardless of their religion, to stop the chaos. Hugo Grotius tried to do it for international law, trying to find basic rules for war that applied to everyone. Spinoza tried to do it for the human soul.
And Holmes points out that for Spinoza, this wasn't just abstract politics. It was deeply, painfully personal.
Very personal. Spinoza was a Jew living in a predominantly Protestant world. But more than that, his family were refugees. They had fled the pogroms and the Inquisition in Spain and Portugal.
Looking for safety.
Right. They settled in Holland, which was relatively tolerant at the time. But even there, Spinoza was eventually excommunicated by his own synagogue for his radical ideas.
Talk about being an outsider.
He was a double outsider, a Jew in Christian Europe and a heretic among his own people. He had literally nowhere to stand, no group to protect him.
So this cold geometry, this idea of a universal, perfectly logical God, is really a refugee searching for a safe harbor.
Precisely. He was looking for a truth that transcended all the sectarian violence and hatred around him, a truth that didn't depend on what church you went to or what country you were born in.
That really changes how I see the coldness of his philosophy.
Yeah.
It's not cold, it's fortified.
That is the ultimate takeaway of this deep dive. Spinoza wasn't trying to rot us of our humanity or turn us into unfeeling robots. He was trying to find a place where we could stand on solid, unshakable ground. He believed that if we could just understand the true causes of things, including our own volatile emotions, we could stop being slaves to them.
It's really a journey from terror to comfort. Because when you first hear the word determinism, it sounds scary. I have no choice.
Right.
But when you look at it through Spinoza's eyes, the eyes of a guy surrounded by war and chaos, it becomes, I am part of a single energetic whole. I am safe within the logic of God.
And that profound shift leads to what he calls the intellectual love of God. It's not the warm, fuzzy love of a personal human relationship. It's the deep, abiding satisfaction of understanding how the universe actually works and knowing you are an integral part of it. It's the peace of knowing that the burn on your hand was inevitable, so you don't have to hate yourself for touching the stove.
So bringing this down to earth for us today, we obviously aren't fighting the 30 Years' War, but we have our own modern chaos. What does this mean for the listener right now?
I think it challenges us to look really closely at our own anxieties. How much of our daily stress comes from what Spinoza calls confused ideas, from just wishing reality was different than it actually is? Spinoza says, stop wishing. Start understanding.
Don't get mad at the traffic.
Yeah.
Understand the traffic.
Exactly. Look at the cause. When you truly understand the cause, like there is traffic because too many finite modes need to be on this specific road at this exact time, the emotion loses its power over you. You stop taking the universe personally. You stop suffering.
It's back to the stove. Don't cry about the burn. learn about the heat.
And that is the path to blessedness.
This has been a heavy one, but a truly fascinating one. We've gone from a tense classroom debate to the fundamental structure of the cosmos and back to a lens grinder trying to stop a war with math.
It just goes to show that even a supposedly dead philosophy might be the most alive thing there is if it actually helps you navigate the storm.
I want to leave you with a final, slightly provocative thought to chew on. We talked about Canonis earlier, that inner drive that pushes you forward. If Spinoza is right, really right, then your desire to click play on this deep dive today was determined by the dawn of time. A multi-billion-year chain of causes led you exactly to this moment, listening to us.
And your reaction to it, whether you agree with us or think we're completely full of it, is also entirely determined by your history, your biology, your previous thoughts.
Which begs the question, can you actually decide what you think of Spinoza? Or has that conclusion already been written?
Now, that is definitely something to think about at 3 a.m.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We will catch you in the next finite mode.